תגוסוק אינונה ברושותן אדוק קושו ניגים יערבית אינונה רישבית קימנה פת ביערב קוצי גרים נקענק נניה Inuim Nayarimi.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Captain of the ALT, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project. Ocean Research Project is science, education, and exploration. I am currently walking down the beach in Kanak, Greenland, about 800 miles from the North Pole. This is the furthest north town in Greenland that has any kind of real amenities, I guess. I'm currently surrounded by about a dozen dogs, Greenlandic dogs, and they're just sort of milling about and eating whatever washed up on the beach, and really cute dogs. Now, they're a bit dirty and scraggly looking, but they're super cute. Nicole, who is the scientist on board the boat, absolutely loves the Greenlandic puppies. But yeah, I'm walking down the beach, and the reason I'm doing this is because I'm heading to the trash dump. It's about 6 in the morning, maybe 5 in the morning. I don't know, it's pretty early. And I'm going to do some Greenlandic dumpster diving. We'll see what we find in the dumps, in the dump. You can find some pretty good stuff here in the dump. They throw away some pretty good stuff. It's sort of surprising at times. And, you know, they really do benefit from their from being part of Denmark. I mean, Denmark really hooks them up. And so you'll find things in the dump that are perfectly good. But what we are looking for today, in particular, are headlights. I'm going to put some headlights on my sailboat. I'd never put headlights on my sailboat before, and it seems like a really strange thing to do. I mean, normally people do not mount car lights or any kind of headlights on a boat, because typically sailing around at night is no different than sailing around in the daytime. Obviously, you're not going to be able to see as well at night, but generally speaking, you treat the night just the same as you treat the day. You just keep sailing. It's not like there's that much stuff to bump into out in the middle of the ocean. And that's the exact reason why I need to get headlights here, is that there are things to bump into. Lots of pieces of ice. So I can hear the dogs howling. Always dogs howling somewhere around Greenland. At least around these towns. I've got to put some gloves on. I'm getting cold. It was snowing yesterday. I guess it snowed the day before. Although, I wouldn't know. I was further north. So yeah, there's ice everywhere, and it's going to be getting dark soon. Today is the 19th of August. By the 22nd of August, in just a few days, it's going to start getting dark. And when it gets dark in Greenland, everything changes. So, obviously, you can't see, which, with the ice being everywhere, becomes a big hazard. But also, when it starts getting dark, it starts getting much colder. Last year, by October 1st, it was 20 degrees outside, which I don't know what that is in Celsius. I guess it's like -5 or something. I mean, it's cold. All of our heaters were broke last year, so we were living on this boat with no heat. It was 20 degrees out. We were talking to each other, and like giant clouds of, you know, like giant clouds of smoke coming out of our mouths. It was cold. And that was a lot further south than here. I mean, that was, I don't know, 700-800 miles south of where we are right now. So I need to go over here. There's all sorts of like broken cars and tractors and snowmobiles and all sorts of stuff like that in this dump. So I'm going to go over and see if I can find me a, you know, like a broke down truck or a broke down tractor or something. I'm walking over a river right now. You could probably hear the river in the background. Been a lot of rain lately. Been a lot of stormy weather lately. So all the rivers are sort of, they're sort of flowing hard right now. But it is pretty. It's a pretty time of year. One nice thing about this time of year is that you get these really long sort of sunsets and sunrises. It hasn't quite got to the point where the sun sets completely. So you get these long, like, 3-hour, sunrise or sunset looking skies. It's really beautiful. But it is getting colder. So the idea is, hopefully, I can find some headlights. Take them out of the broke down vehicle in the dump, and then take some crates. There's all sorts of crates laying around all over the place, and try to build a little housing, a little box for them, and then mount it to the front of my boat. And then when it gets dark and you're out underway, you flip a switch, turn the headlights on. I'm probably going to have to run my engine in idle if I'm sailing because, well, first off, the power in my batteries. I had to get new batteries at the beginning of the season, and I sort of got ripped off. I spent like $600 on two batteries. They're like 4C batteries, but they just don't hold a charge, and they don't hold it for very long, at least. But anywho, I'll need these headlights to try to see the ice at night. So, and I'll need to find some kind of wood. But wood is actually plentiful in Greenland, which seems kind of crazy considering there are no trees in Greenland. Or at least very few trees, and what trees there are 1,000 miles south of here. But the reason for this is because everything is shipped in on pallets. So, everything gets imported into Greenland. You know, basically, they have no exports. They don't have any manufacturing. They don't have any farming. They don't have any farming, like, agriculturally speaking, or any sorts of, animals. I do hear that they have some sheep in the southern part of the country. But the sheep are just they get eaten locally. They're not an export. So everything comes into Greenland on pallets, or at least a lot of the stuff does. So there are pallets just all over the place, and nobody burns wood in Greenland. Typically they burn kerosene. Sometimes they burn like a coal pellets. But all the houses are heated, typically with kerosene. So they treat the wood like trash, and you can just find it laying around all over the place. Broken pallets, broken crates. Some of them are in good shape, some of them are all busted up. Sometimes you find ones that look brand new. What I don't understand is why nobody ever has a bonfire. There are youth running around, teenagers, and there's wood all over the place. I don't know why they don't pile it up on the beach and have a bonfire every once in a while, but they don't. So the wood just sort of sits around. So we use it. I have a wood-burning stove in the boat. I installed one this year. It's a small little guy, but it makes a big difference. I mean, it's really nice to have some form of heat. And I just like wood. I like burning wood. I like how it smells. I like the whole thing. I like looking at it. I just really, really enjoy it. So we put in this wood-burning stove with this idea that we're going to be coming across a lot of wood laying around on these beaches. And we have plenty of it. I mean, I've got a 55-gallon oil drum that says Texaco on the side that I chopped the top off of and made a little wooden lid. And it's sitting on the back of my boat. And it's full of wood right now. We actually have more wood than we can burn. It's like overflowing. So, it's sort of interesting, but to think about that there's, this large supply of free wood in a country that has no trees. But anyways, I'm just moseying on down the beach now, starting to pass broken boats, busted dinghies. There's an 85 horsepower outboard just sitting in the sand. Lots of sort of trash strewn around. There's a dead dog sitting there, just laying there dead. Lots of other dogs just tied up and tied around. Oh, there's a poor dog tied to a light post that has wrapped itself around the light post several times. I should go try to help the dog. The problem is these dogs are half wild. You don't go and pet these dogs, you know, they'll bite your hand. But yeah, there's just all sorts of crap strewn around. Hey, doggy. Here, boy. Come this way. Come on, doggy. All right, he's sort of unwinding himself around this pole. Here's another 90 horsepower outboard. And another, there's like outboard pieces laying everywhere. Come on, dog. Keep going. So yeah, it's, I don't know, you know, it's without the help of Denmark, I mean, Greenland would be absolutely impoverished. It gets about $50,000 of subsidies per person per year, and that really helps keep it afloat. But sometimes I feel like they don't manage their stuff the greatest, because there's just stuff everywhere, all over, just laying out, you know. I mean, there's a washing machine, there's a heater, there's another outboard. It's just stuff everywhere. Oh, and there's the cutest little Greenlandic puppies I ever seen. Jesus, there's a half dozen of them, and they're like, oh, they must be just a week old or something. Jeez, I'm glad Nicole isn't here. She'd be going crazy. One of them's damn near fitting the palm of my hand. Anyways, I'm being distracted. I must continue to the dump. The dump is just outside of town. Maybe a 15-minute walk or something like that, when you're not distracted by dogs. But so hopefully I'll be able to find some good lights here. We're really going to need it. As I said, things really do change once it starts getting dark. And we got a long way to go. The sort of an issue here is that when you leave the region I'm at, about 100 miles south of here, you pass a place called Cape York. After Cape York, there's really nowhere to go for hundreds of miles. There's something called the Nature Reserve, but the Nature Reserve, nobody lives there, and there's nowhere really to hide, and there's tons and tons of ice, and so you can't really stop there. And I'm being run up. There's like three dogs running up to me right now. Anyways, what's up, dogs? Want to say something? Hey. All right. I'm like surrounded by dogs at this point. Anyways, come on, dogs. I got a radio show to do. So anyways, you can't stop in this nature reserve. So you have to cross Baffin Bay, and you have several hundred miles, you know, a few hundred miles, at the very least. And you really got nowhere to stop. So there's no way we can do that section without it getting dark. At, you know, at least a couple of nights. It's going to take us a few days to get through there. There's ice all over the place. And of course, if you're sailing along, and the weather forecast right now looks like there will be some winds, northerly winds, maybe 20 knots or so. So we should be moving pretty well. And you don't want to go slamming into a piece of ice at 5-6 knots in the middle of a bay, hundreds of miles from land, or 100 miles from land, 200 miles from land. That would be bad. So we gotta find some lights. And I'm just being mobbed by dogs. I can see, like, I don't know, 100 or 200 dogs right now on the hill right next to me. They're really cute. But this is like the, ooh, that dog's growling at me. Anywho, maybe I'll walk closer to the beach and further away from the dogs. But yeah, so it's good, though. We wrapped up this project, and I'll get into that after the commercial break, talk more about what we've been up to the last couple weeks. It's been a couple weeks since I've been able to do a show, because it's just been so incredibly busy. I mean, we had all this bad weather, and you know, it really trapped us. We had three storms in 2 weeks, and these are like 50-knot storms that were gusting 60 and gusting 70, blowing me off the anchor. I mean, I got a giant Rockna anchor. I have a 70-pounder. It's massive for this boat. Come on, dog. What you want? I know you want attention. Come on. Anyways, trying not to trip over dogs. They're everywhere. So we had all this bad weather and all these storms, and we got another one coming. We got another one coming soon. So, you know, it was just hard to get to work. It's hard to do this survey. You gotta be around heavy ice, and you know, you're trying to use the sonar to map the seafloor, and you can't really map the seafloor if there's any kind of wave action. You can't really do much if it's blowing 50 knots. I mean, that and these are storms that lasted a couple of days. It's really odd weather. Normally, when you have bad weather in this part of Greenland, normally it's blowing out of the north. If you have strong winds, and this year all of the winds have been out of the south, all of them, all the strong winds have been southerlies, out of the same direction actually. So I don't know what the hell's going on up here. It's very strange. We were here last year and it was nothing like this, and it's just, I don't know if it was the El Nino or maybe I was kind of afraid that, all right, dog, I was afraid the El Nino was going to affect the weather up here this year, and I think my fears have come true because it has been really nasty. But whatever, you know, we got no choice. We just got to keep pushing on. But I'm approaching a trash dump here. I don't know, I got another 100 yards or so till I get to where there's this whole row of busted boats laying on their sides. Some of these boats are actually really cool. Some of them are like relics from the 1940s and the 1950s. But the other half are actually fiberglass boats that look like there's nothing wrong with the hull. And you probably have to put a new motor in it and do a bunch of work to it. But, I mean, the boat itself looks like they would float. I don't know what the hell they're doing just laying around. But after that, there's a whole row of broken tractors and then broken trucks. And I mean, there's not that many vehicles in Connacht, but there are a few. Therefore, there are a few broken ones at the dump. So let's see if I can find me a headlight or two on a old rusted out, broke down whatever that's been laying around in the dump. I'll see you guys after the commercial break.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly from Skipper's Review, and you're listening to Boat Radio.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames, from the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel, to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures. I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places, and boarding the ships that work this mighty, muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.
Ah, this is Edward Smith from OPA Racing.
This is Ken Little, president of Glock Performance Boat Challenge.
Hi, this is Frank Pillsbury with Marine Max and the DFW International Boat Show in Dallas, Texas.
We explore all kinds of boating topics on Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show. Hi, I'm Captain Bob May. We get underway, making way, Saturday evenings here on Boat Radio.
This is Heather Lohe, director of membership for Boat US. Thanks for listening to Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show.
Hello, and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, standing in Greenland, northern Greenland, right outside the trash dump of Connacht. And I was dumpster diving, seeing if I could find a couple of old headlights for the front of my boat. And I've done pretty good, I guess. I found a lot of the vehicles were sort of already vandalized. I think it's just due to local kids, is my guess. A lot of the windows are broken out, and most of the headlights have already been broken. And, you know, there's a little scattered glass and stuff around the vehicles. So I guess, you know, the kids probably come up here every once in a while and break windows. You know, I mean, kids do that all over the world. So, but I did find one headlight that wasn't broken. And I found another headlight off an old snowmobile that had caught on fire, and most of it was melted, except for the headlight. Well, part of the headlight housing is melted, but I think the light itself, hopefully, is still okay. So that's great. That's a great score. You know, you never know what you'll find in a dump. So last time I talked, I was talking about you know, parachute sea anchors and drogues and sort of what to do in this situation where you get blown off your anchor and you have a lee shore, or what to do in heavy weather. One of the things you can do at the very least. So we'll be heading back to that same exact location later today, where, or at least we're going to try to, where I recorded that. And it's a really interesting location. It's at the very end of an old glacier, a receded glacier. So you have a lot of moraine on either side. It's kind of like imagine the claws of a crab or the claws of a lobster. And you know, a little more U-shaped instead of V-shaped. But those claws are 100 to 200 foot tall mounds of rock that extend out for maybe a quarter mile on either side of you. And at the end of this is the old glacier that has receded back a couple hundred feet. So the glacier no longer calves off icebergs. It's very safe in that regard. It's just sitting there melting and it's slowly receding. This used to be a mighty glacier at some point in time, I don't know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, whatever. And it's just receded back over time. This makes for an excellent place to drop an anchor. You have protection from these big, long mounds on either, you know, in front of you and behind you, and you have a pretty good holding underneath of you because these glaciers really grind up and churn up the rock as they grow and as they recede. It's sort of a sandy, light, gravelly mix. Of course, there's all sorts of rocks down there, too, so you got to be careful, and that's always a concern is... You could snag your anchor on something. I'm using something called a anchor rescue this year, which I haven't had to use yet, but it's this device you actually put on your anchor, and the idea is that it's sort of like a trip line, kind of. It's like you don't need to use a trip line. Trip lines are a pain for anybody who has... try to deploy them. And most people don't really deploy them. I mean, I'm sure there's some people that do religiously, but typically most people don't put a trip line on their anchor. But this is sort of a system that has a trip line that's sort of waiting in place. You can look it up. I think it's called Anchor Rescue. Same people who make the Monitor Wind Vane sell it, Scanmar International. But anyways, haven't had to use it yet. But in Greenland, you know, the bottom is so foul, there are all sorts of rocks and you know, who knows what you're dropping your anchor on. So it's always good to have a backup strategy to get the anchor back up. Now, we have drug anchor in this place, and it's sort of been a difficulty in the last few of these storms, is that we have been we've been dragging anchor. And like I say, I got this big anchor, and it's sort of surprising, but when it's blowing, you know, 50 and 60 knots, I guess... Even with a big anchor, if it's not really well dug in, if you don't have a really good bottom under you, you can drag. But eventually the anchor seems to find its hold, and it hasn't been a huge issue. It's made for some excitement, as I talked about in previous episodes. So the weather, it's been really nasty, and we had these storms come in one after another out of the south. But eventually this has sort of dissipated, and we had about a two-week window of calm weather, which typically up here you get a lot of calm weather. I mean, that's sort of the norm, and we needed that desperately to get to the research. So we are doing a big project with a group of NASA scientists and a program called Ocean Melting Greenland, or OMG. This group of NASA scientists are basically collecting data on Greenland in an unprecedented level. I mean, they're mapping out Greenland from every different angle. What we're doing in the water is just one part of it. And really, most of the money that's being spent is being spent from the air. They're flying these special airplanes that have this giant gravitational sonar, radar, I don't know, it has a really big fancy name, but basically it's a super precise device that can accurately measure the height of the glaciers down to like, you know, a quarter of an inch or something, you know, I mean, it's super accurate. So by flying this over Greenland every year for the next 5 years, they can measure whether or not the Greenland ice cap or any of the glaciers have shrunk, have gotten shorter, basically. And, of course, it's super expensive. It's a very expensive plane. You know, it's a multi-million dollar system. You know, but this is NASA. I mean, NASA obviously has the money, and they have some pretty crazy equipment. But, yeah, so we are the ones in the water. So what we're doing is we are looking for this warmer water column coming up from the Atlantic and eating Greenland's glaciers from underneath. And what this means is you have to first map the seafloor using a sonar. That's a whole ordeal within itself. Mapping the seafloor, doing a survey. Hydrographic, people who do, this is hydrography and bathymetry, and people who do hydrography talk about it like mowing the grass. You have a line plan that's given to you, and you got to go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth following these lines within 20 feet of the line, which is just a bit of a nightmare. But, because it's hard, I mean, when you get fog that comes in, you have no point of reference, it's super hard to stay on the lines, and you can't really have much wind, because if the wave action picks up and you're getting bounced around, it's hard to get an accurate reading of the floor, of the seafloor, and there's ice everywhere. So, you know, you got to go around giant icebergs, and that's going to make it impossible to stay on these lines from time to time. So It's a long, arduous process, and we had about 1,200 miles of mapping we had to do this year, and this dog is going crazy in the background. I finally quieted up. We had about 1,200 miles of mapping we had to do in this uncharted region. This was one of the last uncharted regions of northern Greenland, or of western Greenland, and the West Greenland, there's, you know, everything north of Upernavik you're not really going to find charts for. So uncharted, in this case, you know, you're still not going to find a chart for a lot of these other places either. But this was really a big mystery, and you know, very little research has been done in this area. And basically what we've done this year is, you know, like 1,000 times more scientific data collection than, you know, it's ever happened, which is really cool to be able to get up in this region and do this. But what it involves is not just mapping out this fjord that's roughly 80 miles long and 20 miles wide, but all of the sub-fjords. There's a lot of sort of fjords that come off of Englefield. Englefield breadening. Breadening is means opening. So it's sort of hard to define a little bit what Englefield is. It's just kind of, they describe it as an opening. You could also describe it as a fjord. But anyways, there's sub-fjords that come off of it. At the end of these sub-fjords are glaciers. Sometimes one glacier, sometimes three glaciers, four glaciers. Also at the end of Englefield, there's a whole bunch of glaciers. These glaciers are always calving off ice. Some of them are more benign than others. Some of them are very active, with a huge amount of ice leading up to them. So it's just a lot of pushing through heavy ice. And there's an island near the end of the fjord on the northern side, and behind this island is like six glaciers, and all this ice gets kind of trapped by this island. So there's this whole one section of this that is just, you know, there's more ice than water. It's just ice. You're pushing through ice water. I mean, it's just ice is everywhere. Everything from little chunks the size of ice cubes to big, massive icebergs that are 100, 200, 300 feet tall and hundreds of feet deep. And it's just this absolute mixed up jumble. You can only go into this sort of ice in absolutely flat, calm conditions. You never would want to push into this if there's any kind of weather, because the wave action could get in there. Now, you're bouncing around, the ice is bouncing around, it's a bad situation. And we did have a little bit of this on one day. We were in a different section near the end, but it was still almost as icy. I mean, it was very little open water, just ice everywhere. And it was supposed to be flat calm, and a swell came in, and there was no real wind, so the swell must have been coming all the way down the fjord from some wind that was, you know, 100 miles away or something. But, you know, all of a sudden it gets a little bouncier. The ice is bouncing. You're bouncing. And, you know, it just, you don't want to be surrounded by ice when it's all getting pushed around. And, you know, the icebergs start, you know, bouncing off each other, start bouncing off your boat. So we got out of there and did another section for about 24 hours. But, you know, we work around the clock. So when we have the weather, you work 24 hours a day. You work in shifts of 5 hours on, 5 hours off. It's the same sort of thing as when you do a boat delivery. You know, if you're delivering a boat down to the Caribbean or back up the Caribbean or across the Atlantic, Pacific, whatever, it's the same system. I do 5 hour watches. I've done all sorts of different watches over time. I've done 3 hours on, 3 hours off, 4 hours on, 4 hours off. I hear about people who do two-hour watches, 2 hours on, 2 hours. I think that's crazy. I like five-hour watches. It's a double-edged sword. On one hand, 5 hours is a long time to be on watch. On the other hand, 5 hours gives you the ability to actually get some real sleep. For me, when I get off watch, I'm typically pretty wide awake, and it takes me a half hour, 45 minutes to actually fall asleep. And so, you know, you can sort of count the first hour of your off watch as you can sort of scratch that time off. And you might also want to eat food. I mean, you got to cook meals. I don't know, take a shower maybe every once in a while, you know, that sort of stuff. So it's nice to have a long off watch so you can really get some proper rest. And I think it's worth it. And, you know, like I say, I've tried all sorts of different watch systems, and this is the one that I have stuck to and have been using for a couple of years now, and it's what I prefer. So, you know, we work around the clock, and you just got to take advantage of the weather. You know, you got to, it's a lot of area, 1,200 miles, a lot of mapping. I mean, it's basically like mapping from the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay to the Virgin Islands. It's a long, long way. And there's rocks hiding all over the place and ice everywhere, and it's completely uncharted. And so you go really slow. I mean, you work your way up into this ice. You're going, you know, one knot or a knot and a half. And you don't want to go too much faster because sometimes, I mean, you hit pretty big chunks. Every once in a while, you'll hit a chunk that will bounce down your hull, and you'll see it pop up on one side of the boat or the other, and it will have quite a bit of bottom paint on it. You know, little marks of bottom paint. I probably have swapped bottom paint with, I don't know, maybe 25, 30 pieces of ice this season. It can be a bit disconcerting, as you can imagine, hearing a chunk of ice the size of a refrigerator bouncing down the bottom of your boat as you're moving along. But, yeah, you get used to it. And I have a steel boat. It's actually not the thickest steel in the world, but it's a steel boat nonetheless. So, yeah, and I have a high water alarm. Every once in a while, if you hit a big enough piece, you run down and throw open the bilge and see if any water's coming in. I have something called Sith plugs. Sith no plugs are like a sort of like an epoxy-based patch repair kit for holes. And they are specially designed for cold water. So they can actually, you know, resin typically doesn't like to activate when it's cold. So these Sithno plugs were designed to be able to harden very quickly within a couple of minutes in very cold temperatures. So the theory is that if I do get a hole, I should be able to shove a bunch of this stuff in there and it'll harden in a couple minutes and then I won't have a hole anymore. Or at least I'll plug the hole enough that I can keep up with it with the bilge pump. But there is no haul-out facilities up here. I mean, there's not even a dock up here. There's nothing. There's Connacht, but Connacht doesn't really have much. It's not much of a town, really. I mean, there's about 1,000 people here, but it has very little. I mean, there's not a restaurant in Connacht. There's not a bar in Connacht. There's certainly no university or anything. There is one grocery store. But, you know, sometimes they have eggs, sometimes they don't have eggs, sometimes they have produce, sometimes they don't have produce. It's understandable. I mean, we're super far north, but it's just not really a place that you want to get in trouble. So, you know, you do your best to push your way slowly through the ice, and you have somebody on the front of the boat we use a long whisker pole, and somebody's up there constantly pushing the ice and sort of giving you directions, turn port, turn starboard, slow down, hit reverse, you know, go in reverse quickly, and sort of, you know, you work as a team, and you work your way through this heavy ice. And one day turns into the next, it turns into the next, and next thing you know, you've been doing it for 12 days, 14 days around the clock. And you got a lot of work done, you know. And so we finally finished. But I got to cut the commercial break, and I'm going to leave the trash dump and start heading back to the boat. Talk to you in a minute.
Hi, I'm Dave Dempsey from Marine Intelligence. If you're the owner or captain of a superyacht, then you know how expensive internet can be. And yes, it's a ripoff. We've made it our mission to revolutionize the world of marine communications. we will find you the best price for your internet by comparing all major vendors. And we do that for free. That's right, no charge to the boat. It's a free service. We get you the best price for your yacht, whether it's just one boat or a fleet of boats, and all the savings will be passed on to you. We can save you over $1,000 per meg. So stop doing what you're doing and visit marineintelligence.net now, before you forget.
Hello, I'm Captain Bob May from Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show, and you're listening to Boat Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, and I am currently walking back from the trash dump in Conock. Got a half-melted headlight that I pulled off of a Ski-Doo, and I got to get some wood from a crate that I'll find. There's plenty of half-broken crates around on the beach. And when this next storm comes in, which is going to happen tonight, actually, I will build a little box, waterproof it, paint it, and mount it to the front of my boat, and we will have headlights. And these will be, well, it could be a lifesaver, ultimately. But these will come in, these will be very important as we head out of here. As I mentioned earlier, we have a long stretch of several hundred miles to do crossing Baffin Bay. There is nowhere to go, sort of nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. You just got to push through it. And it's going to be dark at times, because it's going to be dark just starting in a couple of days. And that changes a lot of things up here. Makes it a lot colder, and it typically makes it stormier. Although, geez, I don't know how it's going to get much stormier. It's been such a stormy summer up here. It's been really incredible. It was so stormy the other day. I did the last video blog, and I was saying that it was blowing and raining, and it's been so stormy that it washed the roads out of Conock. There's like a bunch of roads in Conock that are no longer here, or like sections of the roads are no longer here. You know, it's been bad weather when there's roads get washed away. And it also creates really strong tides. So we were noticing some incredibly strong tides, because all of a sudden you got all this extra water getting dumped into these fjords and into these regions. So, yeah, it's been wild. It's been a wild summer up here. Beautiful place, though. But anyway, so we finished the survey, and it took us about 5 weeks to do it, and a lot of that was because of heavy weather. We should have been able to do it in 26 days, maybe 23 days if we were really, really lucky, but we should have been able to do it in 26, and, you know, it ended up taking 5 weeks. But you can't operate when it's all nasty outside. And it's great to be finished with this. We had issues. God, you always got issues. We got a bad transducer, which was a horrible thing. In an earlier episode, I talked about how this important sonar had broken, and it was really screwing us up, and we were waiting for another one to get delivered, and then finally it got delivered. And, well, we connected the one that got delivered. We started using it for about 8 hours. And it breaks. And it's like, oh my God. You know, we've had two sonars, both of them break on us. Like, what is going on here? There's only a few things that plug into these sonars. One thing, it plugs into a... And there's dogs all around me again. Hey, dog. It plugs into an inverter, which we have a 2,000-watt pure sine wave inverter. I mean, that's not a problem. And it plugs into a computer. Well, a laptop computer isn't going to fry anything. And a transducer plugs into it. So this transducer, long story short, was supposed to have 10 ohms of resistance, and when I checked it, it only had 3.3 ohms of resistance. So what this means is that the transducer was able to work on high frequency, which is for water 600 feet or less. Come on, dog, I'm trying to walk. And but when it tried to switch to low frequency, which is a much stronger signal, it wasn't able to push through the transducer properly, and it burned out the motherboard on the low frequency side of the sonar, which is rather incredible. I mean, Airmar makes this transducer. Airmar is the largest manufacturer of transducers in the world. And you know, you think that I don't know. I don't think they make this particular model very often. It was a $4,000 transducer. So it's just such a... We put $13,000 into a system that we couldn't use. And because of this $4,000 sonar, didn't have the proper amount of resistance and fried motherboards. God knows what this company is going to do. I mean, hopefully... Hopefully I don't have any more issues. I don't know. So basically, we had a backup sonar system, which was a Simrad system, but you know, it's like a pleasure craft system. It's not a professional grade scientific system, although I have modified it over the last couple of years, and I put several thousand dollars into it, and it does see down about 3,500 feet, and it does record the bottom. So we were able to use it actually to map the seafloor in the area, but it produces a type of file that is very difficult to process. So, although we've mapped out this region, we now have to convert a file, which is going to be very difficult to convert. I mean, it can be done, but it's going to be a nightmare to do it. It's going to take us 10 times longer to process this data than we would have had to originally, had this transducer not burned out these sonars. So, I mean, that was a problem, and that's been a huge frustration of mine. Man, dogs, come on. I can hardly walk right now because these dogs are just... This is... Come on, dogs, let me walk. I know you want attention. Little puppies. They're like little, you know, juvenile puppy dogs. They're very cute, but anyways, they're very wet, too. It's been raining, so they're all soaking wet and getting wet dog all over me. But, so that's been frustrating. We've had some issues with the CTD. The CTD is a probe that you drop down, and this really confirms the existence of this warmer water column because it falls down towards the bottom. You lower it within, ideally within 10, 20 feet of the bottom. And as it falls through that warmer water column, it records it, and then you pull it up, download the data, you look at the graph, and the graph shows a whole bunch of different things, and one of them is temperature, and you say, oh, okay, we found the warmer water column here. Then you have to overlay that data with the sonar data, and it's a whole bunch of work. But that started, the battery connection started freaking out on us. So we were having issues with that. And so it's like we're having all these different issues with our scientific equipment while we're trying to do this survey. It just makes it that much more difficult. And then you throw in all the storms on top of it. You know, we had three major storms. We got another one coming tonight. But we had three of them, you know, stopping us from getting to work. So it's really just sort of been one thing after another. But even with all these difficulties and trials and tribulations, we have successfully mapped out the region, and we've done 121 of these CTD casts and, you know, 1,200 miles of seafloor mapping, which is a hell of a thing to do. It's a really big project, passing this group of tiny puppies again. It's like a half dozen of them. They are so cute. I cannot bring Nicole over here. Nicole would go crazy if she saw these little puppies. She wants a Greenlandic dog. I've been having to, I wouldn't say argue with her, but we've been having many a conversation where we can basically get one of these Greenlandic dogs for free. And we can get a puppy. We asked them how much it costs. Well, Nicole did. I didn't. She asked how much it costs to get a Greenlandic dog. And they sort of looked at us funny. Cause they, I guess they don't sell them. You know, they don't even think about selling them. They're like, well, you could just get one, you know, we'll just give you one, you know, maybe we would give them some tools or, but I'd want to give them something, you know, but, you know, we could get one basically for free if we wanted to. And granted, they are the cutest little dogs when they're puppies, but they're half wild. They must shed like crazy. So, you know, being it's so cold, they actually have two coats of fur. They got like a coat of fur under their fur. So I imagine they'd be shedding all over the boat. And then they grow to be like, you know, 80-pound dogs. I mean, they're 40 kilo or something. They are not little dogs. I mean, they pull sleds through the ice and snow in the wintertime. And I don't know how much they'd like to be cooped up on a boat. So anyways, Nicole's been trying to convince me to get a Greenlandic dog this whole trip. And I've been trying to convince her that when the dog is no longer a puppy, it's going to be awfully difficult for us to manage. So anyways, Lots of issues with the equipment, but we pushed through it. We got the survey done. Beautiful region. Beautiful. We should have a video up on the website about it probably by mid-September. And it's one thing for me to sit here and talk about pushing through heavy ice. It's another thing to see it. You could also friend Ocean Research Project on Facebook or like it on Facebook or whatever. We will be posting pictures up there, and we have already done some. And also there's pictures on the website where the blog is. So, and I'd suggest you go and take a look at it, especially at this video, come mid-September when it's out, because we got a lot of good footage of the heavy ice, so you can really see what that looks like. But we wanted to celebrate after this, and eat our bust has been the motto of this expedition since before we left, since we were in Sisimiut working on the boat trying to get it ready. It's been eat our bust. Ita is a, well, it's not really a town, but there's like two dilapidated hunter huts and one functioning hunter hut. It's about 700 miles from the North Pole. It was a base of operations for various explorers who are trying to get to the North Pole, so it's sort of steeped in explorer history. And it's just a really cool place. Really beautiful. It's a fjord with a glacier at the end. And there's a lot of green there. I don't know if Ita means Eden. Ita is not a Greenlandic word. So it must have been named that. I don't know which explorers named it that. But it seems like this Eden, you know. It's like so green and lush. And it just doesn't seem like it should be that far north. So we went up there and you got to push into a place called Smith Sound to get to Ita. Smith Sound has a lot of pack ice. Pack ice is a very difficult creature, a very dangerous scenario. Pack ice is different than icebergs, and pack ice is different than the mushy, jumbly ice that we were pushing our way through. Pack ice is often low to the ground, maybe only a foot or two. I'm sorry, low to the water, only a foot or two. I'm being distracted by three dogs that are jumping on me. It's low to the water, but it's in big sheets. I mean, you could play a game of football on a piece of pack ice. I mean, they're just huge. So, what, dog? Anyways, so we got to be careful. Because the problem with pack ice is you can have a piece of pack ice, one piece, then go on for like a half a mile or a mile. That, you know, and if you get in between two big pieces of pack ice and they get into like a strong current and end up getting pushed together, it'll squish your boat in the middle of the pack ice. And that could, you know, crush your boat. So you got to be real careful working around this sort of heavy pack ice. And you got to work your way through heavy pack ice to get to Ita. But it's well worth it. Unfortunately, when we showed up in Ita, you know, we've been talking about Ita the entire expedition. It's been sort of one of the things I've been using with the crew to motivate them to keep working hard. You know, it's been like the prize at the end of the expedition. Well, it's not the end of the expedition, but the end of the biggest project. Oh, we'll go to Ita, Ita our bust. We show up there, and there's a damn cruise ship sitting there. It's like, you gotta be kidding me. Damn adventure tourism. I don't know, I hate adventure tourism. The people that work on the boats are nice enough, and the actual adventure tourists themselves are all a bunch of smiley, happy, friendly people. But I don't know, I just imagine this. This is what it's like a little bit. Imagine spending a couple of months hiking to the top of a mountain. All right, you've been working at it. You've been trying to get to the top of this mountain. You know, you've been eating freeze-dried food. You haven't had a proper freshwater shower in forever. You finally make it to the top of the mountain. Round the corner, you're at the summit, and you see a giant helicopter sitting there. Come on, dog, I hear you. Man, dogs. So you see a giant, luxurious helicopter sitting there, and 150 adventure tourists, all wearing matching clothing, all wearing matching jackets, meandering all over the summit. And I don't know, it sort of takes the moment away. You know, obviously luxurious mega helicopters don't exist. But anyways, it's kind of like hiking to the top of a mountain in some remote area, spending a long time trying to get there, going through all sorts of hardships, and when you get there, having 150 tourists walking around in matching jackets with cameras, you know, complaining about, you know, oh, the steak last night was overcooked, and did you try that wine? It was wretched, and oh, we have to make it back for our champagne dinner, and I mean, they're literally things you overhear them saying, and they all come up, you try to get away from them, and they all come up to you in groups, maybe a half dozen at a time, asking you stupid questions, you know, was it hard to get here? How do you do laundry? What do you eat? I don't know, it's just, like I say, the individuals are all nice enough, but it sort of ruins the moment a bit, but you know, adventure tourism, there's a market for it, so they're everywhere, you can't get away from them. And they're in Antarctica, they're in the high Arctic. You know, these guys pay like $14,000-$15,000 for like a 1 week trip. I mean, this is not something, you know, you gotta be really rich to be able to go on these boats. But I don't know. Like I said, they're nice people, but it's really disappointing to run across 150 of them. All of a sudden invade the location. You feel like it's an invasion. You know, you're sitting in this remote fjord enjoying the beauty, and you turn around and there's 10 giant black ribs, each one with 12 people in it with matching red jackets, flying down the fjord right at you. You know, it looks like you're getting, you know, it's like the invasion of Normandy or something. So, but whatever, they left. You know, they were only there for an hour and a half, 2 hours. And we had a bottle of Jameson, so we haven't had a drink in a long time. I've been saving this bottle of Jameson for the end of this project. And so we all sat around, drank the bottle, and had a good time. I had a slight hangover in the morning, which is actually a nice thing when you haven't drank in a while. And the weather was nice and calm, and we came back down here. And now we got a storm coming, and we got to try to get protection. We got to try to get fuel and water, and then we got to run off and try to get protection before the storm hits tonight. There's going to be another like 50, 60 knot storm. But you can see the videos on the website, oceanresearchproject.org. There's blogs on there. Like us on Facebook, and you can always make a donation on the website. So, yeah, thanks for following along, and I'll talk to you next week. Hopefully, I'll be south of Baffin Bay. Yeah, we'll see what the weather does, and we'll see what happens. Alrighty, bye.
Kuena kasi, kuena kurok, kuena kasi, kuena shok.